We've had another big trade in the NBA. I'm Brian Gibberman here with Jordan White on the Podium Game Podcast. Jordan, how you doing today?
Pretty good. How about you?
I'm good. So this one was a, I'd say aspects of it were a surprise and aspects of it were kind of expected. The Cleveland Cavaliers moved Dion Waiters to the Oklahoma City Thunder. The Knicks traded J.R. Smith and Iman Shumpert to the Cavs, and they also got a protected future first-round pick from the Thunder. And the Knicks acquired Alex Kirk, Lou Amundson, Lance Thomas, and trade exceptions, plus a second-round pick in the year 2040. Let's start with, how do you think Waiters is going to fit on the Thunder? Let's start there.
I have no idea. So there's the concept of Dion Waiters, and then there's the reality of Dion Waiters. The concept is that he can be a dynamic scorer off the bench. He can even do some playmaking, run the pick and roll. He can hopefully be a spot-up shooter, which will really help with Reggie Jackson's penetration with that second-unit offense. Maybe they can even play him. They will play him alongside Durant and Westbrook, probably at the two, maybe if they go small with Reggie at the two and then Dion Waiters at the three. And it could be a good thing. Conceptually, this could be a good thing based on Waiters' skill set. And then we go to the reality, whereas like Waiters hasn't exactly shown the capability or necessarily the want to be a second fiddle, to be someone who is complimentary, to be someone who's waiting in the wings, to be that spot-up shooter. He wants to be featured. He wants to be the guy. So I think there'll be a honeymoon period. I think there'll be a 10-game, 15-game stretch where everything will look good. Then I think there's going to be one game where Waiters calls for the ball and doesn't get it, and one of Durant or Westbrook will take the potential game winner, and it won't go in, and then Dion Waiters will start grumbling again. That's how I think he'll fit in. And then, I don't know, it's a weird thing, too, because, you know, this season has already been very trying for the Thunder with all the injuries, and I kind of joked about this on Twitter. It's like, hey, Scott, how are you holding up for the season? It's like, well, I'm okay, you know, the Durant and the Westbrook injuries kind of hit me hard. I'm not sure I can take another, you know, just like, I don't know if I can take another surprise. Like, oh, well, about that, here's Dion Waiters. Have fun.
It's a weird match. I can't believe that we're at the point where Waiters is going to another team where he's going to be asked to play without the ball in his hands. That's amazing to me. I actually thought the Knicks would have made a lot of sense for him because they're not going anywhere this year. He's under contract for another year after this season, so it'd be a perfect tryout situation, and he'd be on a team where he would get to have the ball in his hands a lot. So I thought something like that made sense. I don't really – sticking him with Reggie Jackson, like we're running into the same exact problems we've had with Dion Waiters over and over again. When I watch Dion Waiters, the things I like that he does the most is when he has the ball in his hands, he can attack the basket out of the pick and roll. He gets to the rim. He's not the best finisher, but he can get there. He can draw fouls. He finishes well enough that it's a threat. And he's also a good passer. He's not shy to drive and kick, and which turns into the ball getting swung around the perimeter and it gets a good shot. He initiates offense like that. He hasn't done it consistently. What I see Dion Waiters as is sort of a poor man Monta Ellis. But the difference is Monta Ellis produced at a positive contribution to a team much earlier in his career in a way that Dion Waiters hasn't yet done.
Correct. And also Monta has already gone through his whole transformation in terms of ego. And, you know, obviously Waiters still hasn't done that. And Waiters is young. Like it's easy to forget that he's young, simply because of like not how long he's been in the league, but because of how long we've talked about him from the time that he was drafted way higher than he should have been to his, you know, history with Kyrie Irving to this year. It seems like he's always being talked about, oddly enough. But he is young, so you'd have to think that there's hope for him. Because I really do think it's a mindset thing for him. And if he changes that mindset and is willing to accept the fact that he could be a very good complementary piece, then we're talking about a completely different player and what he means for the Thunder.
And he can play defense. He chooses not to, but we saw it on Christmas Day when he was put on Dwayne Wade, and he did a terrific job playing on-ball defense. Now, obviously, he's still going to get spacey and lose guys. I mean, that's not going to get corrected overnight. But when he engages defensively, he has the foot speed to stay in front of the foot speed and strength. Because he's not like your prototypical 6'6 wing, but he's thick. He's shorter, but he's thicker. So he has some girth to him, and he has the skills to be able to be a good defender. It's just whether he can do it on a consistent basis. Is there something to the culture of the Thunder could bring more out of him than whatever's going on with Cleveland that seems much more negative than positive?
Probably, but I think it's, you know, it's not like LeBron's a bad leader or anything like that. I think it's more just the overall atmosphere. There's all that uncertainty in Cleveland going on right now. Whereas with the Thunder, even though not everything's perfect, there's so much more stability. And that's huge, obviously. There's not a lot of other distractions going on inside the locker room or within the organization. It's just, it is what it is. And I think that could help. I really do. I think Durant's not going to take any crap from him, obviously. But I think also Durant's going to be a bit, I don't even know if this is a term, soft-handed with him. Westbrook, I have no idea. I don't know how Westbrook is with teammates. And that's not like a knock. It's not like puffing him up either. I honestly don't know. But Durant, like, I think he said, we're going to make Dion feel wanted. And I don't think he's felt like that in some time. And it's not going to be like a he better fall in line type thing. I think it's Durant reaching out a hand to try and help him.
Yeah, Durant's quote was that what you just said. That was excellent. That's exactly what you want to hear from your best player, bringing in a player like this. That was the perfect way to handle it. From the Cleveland perspective, as long as JR's foot holds up and Shumpert gets healthy and can play, I really like this. I mean, what you have now is Cleveland has the ability to play small now. I don't know if it works with whether you use LeBron or Love at the four with Tristan Thompson at the five, and then you put J.R. Smith and Shumpert at the two and three with Kyrie at the one. Those are some really interesting lines that could do very well. It's been proven in New York that Smith and Shumpert can play together and complement each other well. And that was with Melo. If you're putting them with someone like LeBron at the four, who's a step above Melo with his playmaking, it should be even better. And you have Kyrie also, because those are two guys. JR and Shumpert don't need the ball in their hands. They can be more of those complementary spot-up shooting pieces that the Cavs are looking for. And can also, Shumpert can help out with the on-ball defense and take some of the pressure off LeBron. I really like how they can fit. If they can find another way to get another big man to fit into their rotation with some rim protection presence, I think this could be a really good move for them.
Thank you. Basically just summed it up very well.
JR's not, he hasn't shot well at this year. He had the highest assist percentage on the Knicks. He's a good defensive rebounder. I think in basketball, when we analyze it, at times we harp too much on the single or the couple times a game when the player in question that's criticized a lot makes a really poor play that sticks out, or he takes a really bad shot, and we ignore all the good stuff that they bring to the table also.
At the same time, though, it is J.R. Smith. Like, you're not sure what you're going to get with him, one way or the other. And he goes through fluctuations in terms of both his play and his focus too. So I really do think that's going to be the not the oddest fit, but I think he's going to be the hardest one to figure into Cleveland's plans. Not necessarily because of his skill set, which ideally would be a very good fit with Cleveland, but more just because how is he going to play? How is he going to react to being in a new situation?
Would you think going to a team from a team that's 5-31 or 5-32, whatever the hell they are right now, to a team that has a chance to win should help? I mean, it's going from New York to Cleveland, but I'm sure JR will make the best of the situation. He'll find odds he likes in Cleveland also.
It should, but then you also have to remember that on a better team, he's not going to get as many shots.
Yeah, kind of a where I think this is part of what leads into JR getting a bad rap. He takes really dumb shots at times. He's not a chucker, though. During his career, he's taken 15.5 shots per 36 minutes. He's peaked at 17.9 when he was in Denver in 09-10. Last year with the Knicks, he took 14.2. The year before, 16.8. The year before that, 15.1. So it's not like he's breaking out of the offense and just completely taking it away and not letting anyone else be a focus. He plays his role, but at times he just takes shots that you're like, whoa, you really shouldn't have done that.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Although I do wonder how many of those 15 attempts have broken the offense.
Good point. You're right. I maybe didn't put that in the best way. Yes.
No, you did. Like I think it is important to show that he's not taking 20 a game or anything like that. But then you also have to look at it. It's like, well, okay, if he's taking 50 shots, are those 15 good shots? Are they 10 good shots? Are they 5 good shots? And, you know, go from there. But I do think it'll be interesting to see how he fits into Cleveland, how LeBron handles him. And most interesting, how Blatt handles him too.
True. We don't have a good amount of evidence on how Blatt is dealing with players. He seems to really, from when I listen to him, the one guy he seems to speak up for and really like the most is Kyrie.
Yeah, I could see that. I'm trying to think if he said anything about any players when they were here in Denver, but not really. He loves Timothy Mozgov, I know that.
And now there's the question. With this trade, do they have a piece that they can somehow get, whether it be a Mozgov or a Kostakoufis, which are the two names that come up the most? Is there a way they can pull off getting one of those guys at this point still?
Mozgov's maybe, but it remains to be seen what Denver thinks of this season. If they think that they can get into the playoffs, which they can't, but if
I really hope they're not thinking like that.
If they think that they can, then they won't deal Mozgov. If they, you know, kind of come to terms with the fact that they're definitely not a playoff team and that they're not, they don't have really the pieces to get much better, then I could see them selling off Mozgov, but it's going to come at a high price because they know that Mozgov is wanted around the league, and it's no secret. So it's not like Cleveland really has a piece in terms of a player that Denver would want, I don't think, at least. Just thinking about their roster, and no. So they'd want to get a pick, like a first or multiple seconds. I don't know if Mozgov's worth a first. He's good. He's not as good of a rim protector as his reputation pretends him to be. So it obviously puts them in place to make a move. I just don't know if they're going to be able to make a move.
That's it. You look at their roster. I don't really see what they have to make a move. I said this when they made the Kevin Love trade. And I said a couple things around the time of the Kevin Love trade that people thought I was crazy about. I said they should have tried to move Kyrie instead of Wiggins. Some people agreed with that. Some people disagreed with that. I also thought it would have made more sense from how this team fit together if the Cavs would have traded for Tyson Chandler and not Kevin Love. And I think that's kind of came to fruition.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about that. But yeah, that makes... I mean, that obviously would have given them the rim protection that they need and that presence inside. But I also think a lot of this is how much of this is if... Would we be talking about this if they had a coach who just ran the LeBron Love pick and bop and pick and roll? Because I don't think we would. I think we'd be talking about, holy crap, this team is good. That's not to say Blatt is a bad coach. He's just been very reluctant to adapt and be flexible in the NBA versus, you know, the system that he ran in Europe.
It remains to be seen whether it's from injury or not, but I do think we're reaching the point in LeBron's career where he's going from super-duper elite top five player of all time level to, yeah, he's still one of the top five players in the league, but he's not that Swiss Army knife that you could just make every single, you just stick any player on the team with him and it's going to work no matter what. So I don't know if I like Love and LeBron together. I think it can work offensively, but I don't know if it can work defensively anymore, especially when you add Kyrie into the mix, who's playing better on defense, but playing better from what he was doesn't mean he's a positive. So you're going out there and you're having three negatives on defense. I don't even know if you put an elite wing 3-and-D guy and a good rim-protecting center, I don't know if that covers up for the flaws that they have defensively.
See, this is why LeBron should have just gone to Phoenix.
Yeah. And not without, but the thing is, he should have went without, unless it was Bosch going with him, he should have just went to Phoenix, signed with their current roster, and played with Bledsoe. And
oh, yeah. No, I mean, it's more for the fact that, like, he would have been able to work under their trainers, and they would have, you know, elongated his career, and he would have been able to break every single record. Well, I mean, you know, it's a little bit hyperbolic, but still, can you imagine him if he had those trainers?
And playing next to a 3-and PJ Tucker who plays defense and Alex Len, a real center. And Bledsoe, who's a guard that plays defense and is one of the best on-ball point guard defenders in the league. That's a team that conceptually would have made a lot of sense. So,
and Goran Dragic. How dare you forget about him?
Well, I don't know if... Something might... I don't know how that all would have worked money-wise. The Suns should go after Love.
Yeah, they should. They really should.
I wouldn't see. This is where I'm split on it, because if I'm the Suns, I wouldn't. It's not that Alex Len isn't worth Kevin Love. It's to maximize having Kevin Love on my team. You need to have Alex Len. So
yeah.
I wouldn't include him in a trade, but from the Cavs' perspective, exactly what they need is if Dragic, the Suns could offer Dragic, Len, and Tucker as the base for a deal for Love. That's exactly what they need to make LeBron work. Which is the same, it's basically the same concept of if LeBron would have went to Phoenix, why it would have worked.
Right, right. I was just more from the standpoint of, you know, the trainers, and then LeBron would have been immortal and just broken every record and won, like, 12 titles.
Well, that would have been a nice little bonus on the side, too.
Yeah, sure.
It made sense. It made sense from every perspective outside of...
It was never going to happen.
Yeah.
That was the only one.
Cleveland was his home, and the Suns aren't an attractive enough market to make him... It's not a Miami or an L.A. that would have been attractive enough for him to give up going home.
Before we move on to what this means for the Knicks, and so I can just like let you go on however long of a role that you want, we can talk about how Shumpert also fits in. Because I think he's going to be more what Waiters ideally should have been. I mean, he didn't quite develop as much as Knicks fans probably hoped he would, or at least not into the mold that Knicks fans hoped he would, but if he can be that 3-and-D guy for Cleveland, that's huge.
He's one of those guys that less is more.
Yep.
He was at his best with the Knicks when he concentrated on taking catch-and-shoot threes and playing defense. This year, his defense fell off a cliff as he was trying to do some more ball-handling stuff in the triangle. So I guess ego issue isn't nearly as much as it is with Waiters, because he has proven he'll fallen back into the complimentary role, but part of him still thinks, hey, I was a point guard my whole life, including in college, and then I was drafted and I played point guard as a rookie, that he still wants the ball in his hands. But once he gets healthy from his shoulder, I think he'll slide nicely into what the Cavs want him to do.
Yeah, that's what I think too. I think he'll fit real nice into their plans and into their scheme. Do we want to move on to New York? So you can just go.
Sure, I'll talk. Here's this. It's what the Knicks do, and what they do consistently is they put everything into one avenue of a way to build a team. That's it. So right now, where they're at is everything is in free agency. Why I like the Tyson Chandler trade, even though it hasn't worked out as expected, is that it wasn't a Knicks-like trade. They traded a guy on an expiring contract who looked like he was declining. It's turned out he wasn't declining it. It's just Knicksian stuff that he sucked for them. Or didn't suck for them. He didn't play up to the level that you would expect the Tyson Chandler to play. But they got back three guys on rookie contracts with, and then Calderon, who you thought, all right, this is the process of starting to build a team. He's a triangle point guard. He makes sense. They'll find a center somewhere else next summer, and you're starting the process of making a team that makes sense together. What this trade is, it's them going back to their old ways of, we need all the money, we're going to just put everything into free agency, and we're going to hope for the best. You traded two useful NBA players, and you got nothing in return. When you could have let them come back, seen what Shumpert developed into, maybe he plays well again and you can raise his trade value. You let J.R. Smith stay around. It's only $6 million. It's not like J.R. is making $12 million. He's making $6 million. You still had $20 million in cap space, even if he was on the roster. You had flexibility to add people, even if J.R. was there. So next season, as the Knicks are better, maybe J.R. has his role. Or if you decide, hey, we want this money to use during the offseason, you attach a second-round pick to him and send him to Philly or somewhere else that openly takes players for picks, and you can get him off the books that way. Or he opts out because he doesn't like the triangle offense. It's only $6 million, and he'd rather get a contract that's 3 years for between $4 and $5 million instead of for some long-term security instead of having a one-year contract. So there's just so many, it just feels rushed and unnecessary, and there was no reason to do this right now.
What did you think of Phil's comments?
In the canned and probably written by someone else. it flexibility. I do want them to start bringing up players from the D League and just starting using their roster, kind of like Philly does, to just try people out and try and find low-cost assets. I do think that is smart, but how I would have opened up roster spots for doing that would have been buying out D'Alembert. I would have waited until after the trade deadline, and then at that point I would have bought out Amari and Bargnani if you couldn't have gotten some sort of long-term piece that you thought was going to make sense with them as an expiring base contract in the deal. I just would have bought them out since they don't have any future here, and that would have been three roster spots to play with that.
The other thing is that as attractive as New York is as a city for free agents, has there been any indication based on their play and based on Fisher as a coach that would make it a basketball, like an attractive basketball destination? I really don't know that going after guys in free agency, and now with your guys' future record, you have a very good chance at a high pick. But if that doesn't pan out, I still don't see what the plan is here. It's almost like, well, we're New York, and guys are going to want to come to New York, when that hasn't been the case really that much.
As long the key is not panicking. If you don't get the top-tier guy, which I have no faith they're going to get a Marc Gasol or a LaMarcus Aldridge. I don't even know if Aldridge makes sense for the Knicks because Melo needs to play the four. But if you don't get that top-tier guy, look at the other guys, whether it be a Draymond Green or Wesley Matthews. You can still build a basketball team without the top-tier guy. I don't really like Tobias Harris, but there's an Aaron Aflalo, Thaddeus Young. There's other guys you can go. So you look at that and you see if you can start the process of building an actual basketball team. Don't panic and overspend for people. I have no trust. There's also other ways to use cap space. I have no faith that that is what their actual plan is, though. I'm sure their plan is to spend all $30 million this summer and try and build a team around Melo, would be my guess.
Well, that doesn't sound ideal.
No, I'm not. That's why I said I like the Calderon-type thing, where it's okay adding future money as long as the pieces make sense in what you're trying to do.
I agree with that, too. It's just, it's when it seemed like the Thunder, or when the Knicks at least got Reggie Jackson back, as you know, some people reported, like, obviously erroneously.
Woj is only wrong when it comes to the Knicks getting something good.
Well, I mean, everybody was confused in that hour. Like, that wasn't, like, aimed at anybody. It's like, no one knew what was going on because it broke the internet, or at least it broke Twitter. By the way, this trade was the most Twitter trade of all time. But when it seemed like they were getting Reggie Jackson back, like even though Reggie Jackson is not a good fit in the triangle, it still seemed like, oh, okay, you guys got, you know, a very good player who could be at least, you know, one of your young developing assets for a long time, or you could sign him to an extension. And then it just turns out that they got filler so that they could dump and get cap space. And that seems less than ideal.
You made a very good point in there. Can we make a rule that you can't, like, slow play a trade on Twitter? Like, that was really cruel what was going on. I was sitting there. I was like, what? I was like, just tell me what's happening. And it's like, it was like someone had the ace and the king, and they had all the cards out, but they weren't throwing, they were just throwing a couple chips in at a time. And it was taken, and then there was no, and then Twitter broke, so we didn't even know what happened. That was a stressful hour and a half.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure it was just miserable for you.
The Knicks suck. God. These are the times where I wish I didn't care as much as I did.
Yeah, welcome to fandom and how much it sucks.
You're not attached to any team like that,
are you? I'm not. I was born and raised in Kansas City, where we don't have the NBA, so I never had, like, a team. I have players, like, Brandon Roy is my favorite player of all time, so when he started his very rapid decline, that hurt, but, like, I don't experience this amount of pain like Knicks fans do.
See, it's funny, because I'm, like, the opposite. There's, of course, over time, like, you get it. Like, JR, I got kind of attached to. Melo, I really respect and appreciate because of what he's been able to help the Knicks, well, what he helped the Knicks do at the beginning and help them be decent. But I'm more of a rooting for the cloth person than the player person.
Sure, sure, that makes sense. You know, different types. I've never had a team. I thought I had a team for a bit. I thought, like, the Timberwolves are going to be my team. And I was like, no, I don't want to get attached to this. This is going to be bad for a long time. So I just hopped off that train pretty quickly.
Do people in Kansas City root for Kansas or Kansas State?
Ah, that's a good question. So it's mainly either Kansas or Missouri.
Oh, okay, that's right.
And then there's some K-State contingent, but it's nowhere near as, like, big as the rivalry of KU-MU, although that's not even a rivalry anymore because we don't play each other. If you're smart, you cheer for KU.
Missouri had their moments.
Right. I was talking to Matt Moore about this because he went to MU, and we talked about it from a perspective of it was an intense rivalry, but like when MU would win, it'd always be like they won on a buzzer beater, or occasionally they win by 10 points. When Kansas won, more often than not, it was like a 20 to 30 point blowout. Especially if Mizzou had won the previous game, then Kansas would just come into Mizzou and just rock them. Then they'd always get their payback in football, which, you know, makes sense because KU is just awful at football. But yeah,
Charlie Weiss wasn't able to turn it around.
That was just a terrible coaching hire. It's like, well, he was bad at Notre Dame. Maybe he'll be good at Kansas. No.
What the length of mistakes you were allowed to make if you at any time had Bill Belichick attached to you is amazing.
You get so much freedom.
Yes, you get like 9 lives. It's incredible if you have Bill Belichick with you. All right, somehow we started talking about football. Do we have anything else from this trade we need to cover? I whined about the Knicks, hit on the Cavs, hit on the Thunder. Are there any other aspects of this that we're missing?
Are you surprised at all that Cleveland made a move?
No. That's the least surprising part of this to me at all. I think that was the lock of what was. Out of this scenario, that was the lock. I'm surprised the Thunder took Dion Waiters.
And they gave up a first for him.
Yeah, and I'm surprised the Knicks bailed on JR and Shumpert so quickly. I thought they would. I definitely thought there was the possibility of him getting moved. I just didn't think it would happen right now.
Sure.
The Cavs are closer to the 9th spot than they are the Hawks.
Yes, I agree.
That's insane.
It makes sense. At least from this season. Not looking at the roster, but you just look at everything that's gone on in Cleveland versus the stability. Again, stability is such a huge thing. In Atlanta, the Hawks have just been stable. They haven't had to deal with that many injuries. They haven't had to deal with a major one. Like, let's not forget, the Hawks were really good last year, all the way leading up to December. And then after December, I believe it was 18th, 19th, when Horford went down, everything fell to shit. And in January, I think they won 5 games. So it's not like it's surprising that they're in first and that they're playing so incredibly well, but it's not all that surprising because they were very good last year until they just got riddled by injuries.
The most awkward thing of this NBA season is that Danny Ferry should probably be executive of the year.
Oof. I know, it's weird, right?
Yeah, and it wasn't like everything he did this summer, but so, I don't know, that executive, the weird thing is weird because you build a team and you have to look at it in totality. It's never one off season unless something crazy happens like with the Heat, but that's very rare and basically never happens.
Although I don't see why Ferry should get it because it's not like he made all that like that many moves this year.
But that's what. How do you judge executive of the year? That's where I'm having my difficulty.
So if the Cavs had been good, it would have clearly gone to Griffin. Like, there's no question about that.
Sure.
Because he got Love, he got LeBron, all that. Like, there was no question. But now, though, it's, I don't know, if the Kings had continued along their track and had made the playoffs, then also maybe D'Alessandro would have won executive of the year. But now that's kind of out the window. Now I really don't think that there is a leader because because I look at executive of the year as someone who took moves this past offseason to improve their team. The Hawks really didn't.
Chicago?
Chicago, yeah. That, which is scary, because you could get GM of the year or executive of the year while still being not exactly the greatest executive. And well, it's also Reinstorm's fault for lowballing every single player there is. So, yeah.
Blazers.
That's a sneaky one. Olshay could win that, yeah.
I mean, no, they went under the radar, but Kamen and Blake have really solidified that bench mm-hmm. and complemented that team very, very well. Trying to see who else. That's the two. And then, yeah, because Atlanta, you're right, it's more, it wasn't what they did this offseason, but it was more the entire process of how we built that team. The Korver signing, Millsap signing. I was trying to figure out whether Ferry was the one who traded for Korver or if that was the guy before him, and I couldn't figure it out when I was.
I can't remember. I think it was Ferry, though.
Okay, so I mean that's outstanding, and all the low what he's done with the low level guys on the roster. It's been
that is true. That's true, but it's to me. That's almost like a lifetime achievement award or like an award that's built up over a few seasons, whereas to me, yeah. Executive of the Year means like this past year, so it's who improved their team the most from this year. And that's me. I could be looking at it wrong.
I don't think it's right or wrong, just like people look at most improved in a variety of different ways. People could look right. at executive in a variety of different ways. I mean, but look at the list of low-level guys he signed. Paro, Damari Carroll, Shelvin Mack, who's been solid for them, Schroeder was a good draft pick, Mike Scott, the Teague contract, which was criticized at the time, has turned out great for them. I mean, that's a legit job he did.
Yeah. I mean, it all depends on how you look at it. You know who I would actually maybe give executive of the year to simply because of the position he put his team in for the future? Flip Saunders.
That's an interesting one.
He fell ass backwards into Andrew Wiggins and Thaddeus Young and Anthony Bennett, along with Zach LaVine. And you know, now Shabazz Muhammad is looking good too. Again, it all depends on how you look at it. They're not good this year, but if you want to talk about someone who has set up their team, potentially if Saunders doesn't remain their coach and just focuses on being a GM, then yeah, I'd have no problem considering Saunders for executive of the year in a weird manner.
They probably should have just held on. Giving up the Heat pick for Thad Young is going to look bad.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Depending if they sign Thad Young and they end up, I think he's only 27 or something like that. If they re-sign him at a reasonable price and he ends up on the team, let me see, he's 26. So if they re-sign him at a reasonable price and he's on the team 3 years from now when they're good and they're competing for a playoff spot, fine. If they lose him after this season and Thad Young decides to go somewhere else, then it's not a good look giving up the Heat pick for him.
Right. And a lot of that was also like Saunders' desire to still try and stay competitive while also rebuilding. And that's where their plan kind of got muddled.
Yeah, they were kind of mixed bag. It was kind of confusing to figure out what they were trying to do. They were trying to do two things at once when you should probably just dedicate yourself to one angle.
Focus on one. Yep, exactly.
Anything else you got to add before we wrap up?
No, I think we're good.
All right, that wraps up another edition of the Podium Game Podcast. We'll be back next week.